government is not our master, it is our servant. Its only power, that which we the people allow it to have.
Liberty Watch is an independent program on KVOI dedicated to the notion that government remains servant, not master, and operating in the public interest for which the media in this country was designed by exploring controversy. This helps us to resolve our differences peaceably, refining controversy into clarity through investigation, research, interview of experts, and public feedback. Liberty Watch is based in objective reason and is biased towards individual liberty, and so is not the view of the station or anyone but the host, guests, and callers. Liberty Watch operates outside the realm of political correctness, taking no notice at all of race, creed, religion, ethnicity, political affiliation, or orientation, focusing on content of character in eternal vigilance to the free flow of information about government, technology, current events, and our steadfast Constitution. The program is paid, produced, hosted, and operated by Charles Heller, and any mistakes are solely his responsibility.
And welcome to Liberty Watch, where we have our glitches all flying in formation, and we have a guest with us, Sherry Few, from U.S. Parents Involved in Education. Welcome back, Sherry Few.
Thank you, Charles. Appreciate you having me on this Easter morning.
My pleasure. Yeah. I'm glad you could take a little bit of time, carve a little bit of time out of your Sunday to be with us. And it is always a pleasure, a joy and a pleasure to have you with us. And I'll get right to the topic here. A recent AEI report calls the latest nation's report card results a, quote, five-alarm fire due to horrible learning progress. In 2024, 40% of fourth graders scored below basic levels in reading, and this is 25% worse than in 2013, when 32% scored below basic, and with even worse outcomes in black eighth graders, 56% of whom fell below basic. This report on students is falling behind grade isn't new. We did an interview on this in 2023. Why do people in education continue to do things to the detriment of the education of children?
Well, why is a good question, but I can kind of sum up a few things that I see are obvious problems. So, first of all, it's very, very sad, these statistics, if you think about it. Below basic is the lowest rung on the metric scale. So we're saying that 40% of fourth graders in this country can't even read. And so this is fundamental to all of their other learning. They must know how to read to learn other subjects. And so at this early level in fourth grade, to have 40% below basic is very alarming. So the title of the article you read is right on. It is very alarming. And so, you know, most of the educators want to blame the pandemic. And we know, of course, the pandemic was probably catastrophic to learning because they shut down the schools. Students had to learn on their devices at home. And while that is a problem, we had already seen a decline prior to COVID. So as far back as you even mentioned, 2013, even though it's 25% worse today, it still was not very pretty in 2013 when we had 32% below basic. So I believe the biggest problem is the Common Core standards. So the Common Core standards were pushed on states by the federal government, trying to herd kids into a one-size-fits-all set of national standards. And then the standards themselves had never been field tested. And as far as reading, the K-3 standards were tested to be by experts, psychologists, who there were 100 psychologists that signed a letter when they were trying to pass these standards. And they were not necessarily conservative or Republican. In fact, the leader of the group I interviewed, we brought her to our state to testify before our Senate, and she identifies as a Democrat. But these psychologists understood that the K-3 standards were developmentally inappropriate for children.
But wait a minute. If a person identified as a Democrat, could they possibly be a trans Republican? I'm sorry. You hit my seriousness limit. Go ahead. You're making a valid point. Thank you. Go ahead. I'm sorry.
Oh, goodness. I need to think about my verbiage a little bit. I try to stay away from those words.
Well, you know, I identify as a Sherman tank, but that doesn't make me a trans tank. That's my father. That's the Teddy in me coming out. Sherry, I must lovingly, and I do mean that lovingly, not lightly, lovingly disagree with you. I'm sure that the Common Core standards are a part of the problem, but I'm not the gold standard myself. But when I came to first grade, I had basic reading skills. When I came to first grade, my mom bought me, long before first grade, maybe kindergarten, bought the Abbas Adarian book. And we went through every letter, and I was able to sound out words in first grade. Now, I know people are going to accuse me it's because I'm short, fat, white. If short, fat, and white, I have some advantage. But, I mean, where are the parents in all this? Why shouldn't a student arrive at first grade ready with the basic skill? I mean, I wasn't reading the Wall Street Journal, but I could certainly read slowly. I could certainly read from some of the books my father was reading to me, and he read to me from On the Bottom, which is a book by Admiral Edward Ellsberg about the salvage of the S-51 submarine in 1926 and 27. I was able to slowly pick through most of the words in that book by first grade. And I'm not, you know, I have no extraordinary intelligence. I just do have some good training. Why don't parents do that with their kids?
Well, first of all, I appreciate the way you prefaced your disagreement. And so I'm always very cautious not to blame parents, because it seems like that's what the left is constantly doing, is blaming parents for their own failure. I believe that every parent loves their child and does their best. And I do believe that parents have become dependent on the government and expect. They're entering them into school so much younger now. We've got four-year-old kindergarten.
You know, you got pre-K, too.
Yes, so they're putting them in school so much younger and just relying on the government to do what your parents did, what my parents did, to prepare us for our educational journey. So there is some fault there, but I don't know that they are squarely to blame. I think our society has accepted this as a norm, that you put your kids in there as early as you can. They want them cradle to grave anyway, and they just depend on the government to do their job, and they're failing. So even though, you know, you want to address some of the blame to the parents, I understand that. But you have to understand, too, the point I was making with the Common Core standards and the fact that the K-3 standards are developmentally inappropriate. It causes children to have to think abstractly, which their brain is not capable of doing at that.
Not ready to do that yet. My dad taught me how to have fun with words. He said, learn words that your teachers don't know, and you will flabbergast them. So and my grandmother on my mom's side used to read the dictionary for fun, and she'd read it to me. I would memorize complex words like extraterritoriality and things like that, and slip them into a conversation in grade school, and I aggravated the urine out of people with it. But it sure was a fun way to learn words.
That is. That's a brilliant way to learn words. And obviously you had a very, very good upbringing with all sorts of people in your setting.
What he did was he gamified learning. And what I'm trying to suggest to you is, if we adopt that pedagogy of gamifying learning so that kids are excited and they compete with each other for what they learn, and you instill this thirst for knowledge in people. I don't have a college degree, and yet, you know, I communicate. I do this. I show other people how to communicate. And I, you know, what Paul Simon once said about I can read the writing on the wall, even though I don't have a degree, I can read the writing on the wall. Why don't we do that?
Yeah. Well, and so that was another point that was made by the psychologist I was talking about earlier, who was exposing the developmental inappropriateness. And she says that children need to, at that age, at that very young age, they need to learn through play. And so, you know, that's exactly what you're talking about.
Yeah.
And that's That's not what they do. What they do is they set them in a chair, tell them to sit still and be quiet, and then they try to teach them things that their brains aren't capable of learning.
Yeah.
So, yes, there's a lot of fault in the way the classrooms are structured at very young ages. Children absolutely learn through play, and that's what the schools need to get back to. That's the way it was done when we were young.
Yeah.
And so...
Well, no, there was a disciplinary sit still and be quiet mode in the public schools, even as far as back as kindergarten. Well, not kindergarten, but by first grade, discipline was, you know, we were still in the, what was it, they call it the Austrian method, or what are the industrial model where everybody was learning to work in a factory. Hey, we're over for a break. Can we do that? Go ahead and take that now. I'll dispense with the music and get fast into the break so we can get fast out of it, and then we'll regain our timing. We're with Sherry Few of United States Parents Involved in Education, USPIE.org, right?
Yes, that's right.
If you want to look this up during the break, USPIE.org, back after these messages.
Swap shop trains are coming, rolling down that free market track. Sunday mornings, you can buy, sell, or trade anything lawful and moral on the swap shop. Let's listen.
Never give up on the power of the swap shop.
Who knows? And I mean, somebody could have had a whole bunch of old pagers laying around, and they called the swap shop and said, can we buy them? We got an order for some pagers. We just need to work on them a little bit first.
Swap shop, Sundays 10 to 11 a.m., right before Liberty Watch.
Hi, it's Mark Levin. Liberty Watch on KVOI is dedicated to the notion that government remains servant, not master. Sounds like Charles has been reading my books. Congratulations on 20 years on KVOI, Charles.
Teach your children well. Their father's hell did slowly go by. Don't you ever ask them why, if they told you, you would cry. So just look at them and sigh, and know they love.
And welcome back to Liberty Watch on KVOI, where we have the joy and the pleasure of having with us Sherry Few, who's the president and founder of United States Parents Involved in Education. Give us like a 15-second pitch on USPIE, if you would.
All right. So USPIE has the mission to close the U.S. Department of Education and all federal education mandates. It's unconstitutional for the federal government to be involved in education, so we are focused on restoring local and parental control of education. We know that the government closest to the people governs best, and we need parents and local communities deciding what is in the best interest of the children in their community when it comes to learning.
In that guise, what needs to happen to fix America's educational crisis?
Well, first of all, as our mission states, we need to get the feds out. So, you know, closing the Department of Education, which is on President Trump's radar. He's actually signed an executive order that's already putting that into place. And so beyond that, there are several federal laws that need to be repealed. There's the Every Student Succeeds Act, which the forerunner was Elementary and Secondary Education Act, which was passed in 1965 under LBJ on, you know, addressing the war on poverty. That has evolved over the years. At one point, it was No Child Left Behind. We all know what a disaster that was. So that law needs to be repealed. And then there was another law in 2014 that was passed called the Workforce Innovation and Opportunity Act that merged health and education and workforce development together. And so it's really solidified this workforce development model of education. And for some reason, educators believe that their job is not to teach children, but to prepare them for the workforce. And that's what we see all over our country. They're pigeonholing children at very young ages into a career field. By the time they're in high school, they have to claim a major, which is the field that they will go into. So it's all about workforce development. We're not teaching kids the basic anymore and then letting them and their parents and maybe their faith community guide them in their career choices. Instead, it is an attempt by the federal government to control the economy. So we have got to strip our country of these laws, this federal influence. That's where all the indoctrination is coming from, all of the, I call it transmania that we see going on. In the state of Washington, I was told by a leader there that they have 30,000 children that identify as transgender. It's an epidemic in this country, and it is promulgated from the teaching that is happening, and teachers are trained in colleges and universities before they even hit the classroom on how to embed this at every grade level in every subject. So, you know, that's what we've got to do is we've got to start by getting the federal government out and as I said, restore parental and local control of education. Parents know best. They should be the accountability factor, not these tests that, you know, are showing really poor learning and declines in learning. But parents need to be the accountability factor. Mm-hmm. And quite frankly, Charles, we don't recommend any parent have their children in government school today. Mm-hmm. It has become that toxic. And so the best method for learning for children, in our opinion, is homeschooling. And parents have the responsibility. It is their God-given right to direct the education and the upbringing of their children. So if they can't find a good private school, because even some of the private schools have been corrupted.
Right. It's a derivative of critical theory, which is an outgrowth of Marxism. And, you know, some people, when you tell them oh, it's Marxism, they pshaw and they poo-poo anything you might say. Oh, you know, you use that word and you don't even know what it means. And I don't think they know the derivation of critical theory from the Frankfurt School on in the United States. But the problem, Sherry, is you can't fight something with nothing. You know, you say homeschooling, but how do we promote homeschooling curricula that empower parents who aren't necessarily teachers, although all parents are teachers to some extent or other, but how do we empower curricula and the effusion of knowledge so that people can do this?
Well, that's a very good question, and so I would recommend that your listeners visit a website that is called Public School Exit. It is a very well-done website. There are several people involved with the leadership of that organization who are colleagues of mine, Alex Newman, E. Ray Moore, and several others that are just well-renowned in this area. So there are several alternative models, and homeschooling is not the only option. There are cottage schools where it's sort of like the one-room schoolhouse again, and parents are coming together and combining their resources to hire a teacher to teach their common children. And so there are several models listed on that website that are opportunities. There are great curriculum resources. Classical education, I believe, is the best. It's how we taught children for probably 100 years before Horace Mann and the Frankfurt
right.
School and all of those.
Okay,
and an influence.
Sherry, we're running out of time, and I got a caller that wants to ask you a question, but it's publicschoolexit.org or .com?
I don't have that.
That's all right. Don't worry about it. I'll find out while the caller is talking to you. Mike, you're on with Sherry Few of USPIE.
Good morning, and this is a fascinating subject. I really want to thank you for inviting the guest. As usual, always a good time. Mm-hmm. And she is a repeat offender. I highly recommend her. My question is this. Sometimes I feel like I'm on a roller coaster ride. We've got a president that is doing all the right stuff, but he's not doing it through the right channels. And what's going
to
happen is all of this stuff is great while it lasts, and then in 4 years, we're going to be right back where we were before. My question to you is, do you have any power, any political power? Do you know anybody that can actually nudge the president and say, you got to get this through Congress or this stuff is not going to last?
Right. Excellent point. You're absolutely right. All of these executive orders can just be turned over as soon as we have another leader in the White House. So while I really appreciate the efforts he's making to make these initial steps very quickly to try to right the ship. They are not permanent. We need Congress, absolutely. And he understands that. He's written that into his executive orders. His Secretary of Education has said it on numerous occasions. They understand that in order to effectively close the Department of Ed, they will need the help of Congress. And then there's the laws that I mentioned that are unrelated. You know, the Department of Education actually oversees the budget of those laws, but it doesn't, they are statutes that are required in our country. So I will tell you that while I don't have power or influence with the president himself, we have had correspondence with his Secretary of Education.
1 minute warning.
We're hoping for a meeting with her, and we're also working with some congressmen, praise God. There's a congressman in Alabama, which we think has a good bill, and we're hoping to fine-tune it a little bit for him. So we are working with members of Congress. There are some bills that are on the table, and we're hoping to influence the outcome of those bills.
All right.
Beautiful. Thank you.
You're welcome, and good timing. And I'd say that'll open up a line, but what it's going to do is clear the deck for the next guest. Sherry, we got 15 seconds. Would you like to give your website? I wanted to go into more depth, but oops, we ran out of time. Can you give your website one more time?
Sure. Our website is USPIE, that's USPIE.org. I hope they'll check out our new podcast, Unmasking Government Schools with Sherry Few.
All right, and send me the link to that, and I will, if you don't mind, I will republish some of your episodes on my America's Fabric program, but I must let you go now. I got the guest calling in, okay?
All right. Thanks,
God bless.
Charles.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
And...
Thank you for listening to Liberty Watch.
Swap Shop trains are coming, rolling down that free market track.
Sunday mornings, you can buy, sell, or trade anything lawful and moral on the Swap Shop. Let's listen.
Right? Bunker, 1960, directed by Otto Preminger, starred Paul Newman, Ava Marie Singh.
I knew if I shined the bunker light, it's like the rabbi light, only yours doesn't have the armo kit.
Well, mine has a cowboy hat and a spur on it.
Swap Shop, Sundays 10 to 11 a.m., right before Liberty Watch.
Hi, it's Dennis Prager. Liberty Watch is dedicated to the notion that government remain servant, not master. Goes very well with my concept of E Pluribus Unum, liberty, and in God we trust. Congratulations on 20 years on KVOI, Charles.
Father has a business, strictly second hand. Everything from toothpicks to a baby grand.
And here is a man who has taken secondhand rose to high art. This is Greg Berry. He's the founder of Municibid. He's originally from Pennsylvania, I think still hailing from there. And he studied at Lehigh College, of course, in computer science. And he has a website for beating tariffs by buying things used. Greg Berry, welcome to the microphones and telephones for the first time of Liberty Watch.
Yeah, good morning and happy Thanksgiving, or happy Easter.
Yeah.
I wish it was Thanksgiving. I like the food on Thanksgiving a little better.
Well, yeah. Maybe better than Passover, where we preserve the gefilte fish. Anyway, on Foundation, all entrepreneurs are driven by something to make them go. What is it that drives you?
Well, I mean, I've been an entrepreneur my whole life. You know, from a kid, you know, of course, cutting lawns and shoveling driveways and that sort of thing. And then even into middle school and high school, I always had some kind of something going on. And I actually started my first business the day after I graduated high school in 98. It's funny because it's not uncommon now for someone in high school or younger to have their own business, a YouTube channel and that sort of thing. But back in the 90s, it was a little bit more difficult. I started an IT company out of high school. I had some really good opportunities during high school that allowed me to get really sought after, hard to come by industry certifications that sort of allowed me to sort of dictate my own path. And being an entrepreneur, I thought it'd be great to start my business. Of course, I had no idea what I was doing, but you know, that's probably the reason I started it.
Mm-hmm. Writing your own tests, huh? That sounds kind of Kobayashi Maru. Aha. I have discovered something about you. That's a tell. All right. Please give us your elevator speech on Munisabit.
Well, yeah. So I started this IT company in 98 and still went to college, just did commuting so I could sort of set my own schedule so I can serve my clients. And then fast forward to 2004 or 5. There was a seat that became available in my local town council in Pottstown, Pennsylvania, that was held for a long time by a really good guy, and he decided that he wanted to retire. So this seat became open, and I ran for it and had a primary, won that, had a general election, won that, and so at the ripe age of 24, 25, I was elected to borough council. Of a town of about 45,000 or so. Kind of right away, I started noticing when we were selling our stuff, used police cars, heavy equipment, other tools and items, we would be selling them for pennies on the dollar. So we would sell a used police car that had maybe a Kelley Blue Book value of about $3,000. We'd sell it for $300. And then the next agenda item, we're arguing over saving $1,000, and I'm like, we just gave away $3,000
or so $2,000.
I noticed that, yeah, exactly. And I noticed,
$2,700.
Literally, would sell that car for $300, and it was like that. You would look at the Blue Book value, and it's $3,000, and it's like, what happened? So, I started talking with some other contacts I had in other municipalities, and started doing some more research, and realized that this same problem was an issue for governments all across the country. And at the same time in Pennsylvania, they had just passed the Electronic Bidding Law Act, which basically allowed governments, among other things, to utilize the internet to sell surplus. And it wasn't available prior to that. So then it was like, okay, well, why aren't we using eBay? And it came down to a number of things, mostly around sort of the requirements that governments use, but also
as a vendor,
factors, customer service. Yeah, I mean, there's a lot to go to. You know, they're not in the government auctions business. You know, and so they're not really set up to handle the requirements. So, put this kind of rinky dink auction platform together, and it was good enough to take out and get some other municipalities to try it. Of course, our own couldn't because it would be a conflict of interest.
Right.
So anyway, brought on some other municipalities. They tried it, and it worked. And in fact, it worked so good they felt there was a problem. So it was I think it was the second item. The first ever item was sold was a riding mower. They were hoping to just sell it for $100. They sold it for $500. They couldn't believe it. And then one of the next items was a used police car that with a blown engine, and they were literally just wanting to get off the lot. And so they would have been happy with anything. And the winning bid was $2,800, and they called me and said, hey, there's something wrong with your system. There's no way someone's going to come and pick this up and pay $2,800. Sure enough, next day, guy shows up with a check for $2,800 and takes it away, and they could not believe it. They were floored. So, you know, we had those couple results, testimonials, then went to the next township with that. And it was a lot of convincing, kind of one township at a time. To get going. So it took a couple years to really get off the ground and get going. And now we serve over 6,000 governments.
Wow. You've been at this since 2006, and you developed a competent team around you. Clearly, you've adapted to the market. How did you stay ahead of the curve?
Yeah. So it's interesting. On one hand, so, you know, we're a double-sided marketplace. So so your listeners are clear, so Munisabit allows governments to auction things they no longer need. And we mostly work with state and local governments across the country. We're primarily in the Northeast and Midwest is our kind of our strong territories. But we do have agencies that use us across the country. And then also schools and universities utilize the platform as well. And it's open to the public to bid. So anyone can buy 18 or older in the United States or Canada.
Mm-hmm.
And so we have a double-sided marketplace, so there's kind of two sides. So one, we have to, you know, get governments, show them what we can do, how our service works. And then on the other side, we have to market the items that they're selling to the public. So it's, you know, it's really split in two different ways. With the government, you know, it's not very hard to stay ahead of government. As you know, they run a little slow and they're a little bit behind.
Is it, well, the program called Liberty Watch, you don't have to convince me of that.
Exactly. I kind of picked up on that. and then, on the marketing side of marketing the items, that's a little bit more, competitive and, a tougher job in many ways to stay ahead of the curve with all the different technologies and all the different ways to market and, you know, keeping on top of it.
Mm-hmm. I noticed on your state-by-state listings for Illinois, you have four incarcerated governors up for bid. Have you gotten any traction on them?
Well, they must have slipped through because we don't allow. We've had many times where the people we work with in cities and towns ask us if they can auction their elected officials, and we don't allow that or firearms.
Oh, darn. No firearms? What fun is that? I allow them on my – you know about my swap shop program, right?
I do, yeah.
Yeah. So we allow firearms, but I caution people to make sure they do things that trade – to trade lawfully and only to transfer them to people within the state lines so you don't violate federal law and things like that. But we do that. But I can also understand why you wouldn't, because you have to have an FFL,
well, the other
FFL
thing is
to do
the,
it.
The police departments tend to not want to as well.
Well, in Arizona, they're required by law to do it.
Yeah, that's interesting. Yeah, it's definitely different in various states, which, going back to your other question, that is a challenge with working with governments in different states. In fact, even in the same states, local governments kind of operate differently depending on the type of government or type of municipality they are.
Yeah.
For example, in Pennsylvania, it's like first and second class townships have two very different rules.
Mm-hmm.
Same with boroughs.
Well, in California, you can't legally have a car that's painted black and white in the pattern of a squad car.
You know what? Funny enough, I did not know that. That's
yeah.
Interesting.
I also noticed there was a wood chipper seized from in a RICO seizure from a mafia outfit in New Jersey that was a wood chipper. Any bidders on that one? Never mind, you don't have an answer. While we're on the topic, though, what is the most unusual item you've listed?
You know, it is interesting. We get all kinds of different items. Most of the items are pretty boring. You know, they're items that governments have, you know, bought, used, no longer have a need for. Sometimes they buy equipment for projects, and then the projects end up getting canceled, so they have relatively new equipment. So there's a whole range of types of equipment. So that's about 90% of the items. About 10% or so, if that is forfeited goods. Mm-hmm. You know, seizures, police seizures, mm-hmm. And that sort of thing. And so those are kind of more of the interesting items. One was an interesting story out of Louisiana where there was a cop who actually stole a diamond ring from the property room, the evidence room. Then it was caught, forfeited, of course. They seized the ring back, and then it was sold on municipal. I think it was a 2-carat diamond ring and sold for $20,000. So that was kind of an interesting story. There was also a man living on a sailboat up in Massachusetts who died on the sailboat, and his family, who was from overseas, didn't want the boat, so the town ended up, you know, accepting this boat, and so they had to sell it. So that was another crazy one. And then there's just kind of interesting items. Just a year or two back, there was a Parks and Rec agency, I believe they were also in Massachusetts, that sold a whole arcade, basically, of classic video games, and those really went wild. People ate those up.
So
yeah, it was pretty cool.
An eclectic variety of things. Speaking of eclectic varieties, we're up on our three quarters of the hour mark, so I'm going to take the last break for our eclectic variety here, and then we'll be back in a little bit. You can stay with us till the bottom of the hour, or till the top of the hour, right?
Swap Shop trains coming, rolling down
Sunday morning, 10 to 11 a.m. on KVOI. You can buy and sell and trade anything you want that's lawful and moral to own. Let's listen.
Rick, you're on the Swap Shop.
Hovercraft.
is like on Star Wars, but it's missing engine.
Yeah. Easy, Chewie.
It's got its own trailer. My number is 272.
Swap Shop, Sundays 10 to 11 a.m., right before Liberty Watch.
So suit up, let's go for a ride. Turn on the fire truck's flashing lights. We gotta hurry up and get there fast to save the day. So drive, drive, drive. We gotta go put out the fire. Don't forget to sound the siren. It goes, wee 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 wee.
And welcome back to Liberty Watch, where we have the joy and pleasure of having with us Greg Berry. And Greg is the head of a company called Municibid. So that was a little song about fire engines, a little kid song about fire engines. What's the market for used fire engines? And go into a little depth on it.
Yeah, sure. It's actually a really good question. It's something that we talk about a lot here. We sell a lot of fire trucks. The one issue with fire trucks, well, there's a couple, is the market. The big issue is the as one drives by, perfectly timed. The one issue is the market is just flooded with used fire equipment. It's very saturated. So as a result, that kind of drives the value of fire trucks down. So then it's like, okay, you know, what happens with these fire trucks? Some do go, very few do go to other fire departments, and even fewer are actually used. So the ones that go to other fire departments actually end up just being parade trucks. So there's not a whole lot. They're not able to be certified, but, you know, they don't want to have their main fire trucks, you know, out in parades or what have you. And so they actually have some trucks that are specific for parades or for show and, you know, public events.
So there's a difference between the ones that are for show and the ones that are actually people are going to use.
Right. It's all about if they're able to be certified for use. And again, that varies, in across different states and so forth. But,
right.
So there are actually fire truck collectors who buy old fire trucks and use them, buy them to show. And then there's farms are another big buyer of fire trucks, especially tanker trucks, to be able to water their fields and so forth. So, there's a couple. You know, there's a bunch of different use cases for used fire trucks, but pretty much most of those do not go to fire companies here in the U.S. The one caveat is sometimes they're bought by exporters and they're exported to other countries that are used for fire trucks. So it really, really kind of depends on it. So, you know, and then there's a lot of sentimental value built up in fire trucks and, you know, they're very expensive new. So it's something that we work with our selling partners, fire departments and so forth, to help them understand the market, and so that they have a realistic expectation of what they can sell their trucks for. So these trucks could brand new be $1 million or more, but 30 years later, you really struggle to sell them for $20,000-$30,000 just because of the market. Situation.
Still, who knew that there was an active fire truck market in the United States? I mean, it's just not something you think about. And I mean, I suppose if you've always wanted to run code 3 through a city street, it might be a fun thing to own, but obviously that's not legal.
We'll get you through the morning commute a little faster, that's for sure.
Maybe not. Depends on how thick the traffic is. I've seen lots in Chicago when I was growing up. It was kind of a game to challenge the fire truck and give them just enough room to get by. We didn't do that with ambulances, but we did it with fire trucks. And then eventually the society got to where they wouldn't be tolerant of it, as we shouldn't be. You shouldn't be giving right. firefighters a hard time. Mike, you've right. got a question for Greg
it's
Berry
Ebb.
Of Municipid. Go ahead.
Hey, it's Ebb.
Oh, it's Ebb. I'm sorry. Go ahead.
Hey, I so want to buy a fire truck.
Please do.
Would I have to reasonably spend to get a reasonably okay fire truck I don't need it to pump water. I just need to drive around town and have fun.
Yeah, I mean, you really can buy them for as little as a couple grand that actually still work. We had a really cool story about a dad and his daughter. They live in Texas. They flew up to Pennsylvania to buy this brush truck to be able to tow their boat around. And so they went up, flew up to Pennsylvania, bought the truck, and then did a road trip back home and kind of documented it on the way back. And it was pretty cool. Every time they crossed the new state line, they fired up the lights and sirens, which, you know, might not be recommended, but, you know, it's still, why not have a little fun?
I would so totally do that.
You know, you probably, if you did something along with a municipality, you probably could get permission for a one-time use, you know, to do that and not cause a fuss or a ruckus. Of course, knowing Ebb, he wants to cause a ruckus, but the point
is, a fuss.
Just a fuss, yeah, not a ruckus necessarily. Yeah, so low grade.
I think I would I'd recommend asking for forgiveness more than permission,
right? Yeah. Or, you know, the famous Dick Marcinko Unideer memo. Unless otherwise directed, yeah, this is what exactly I plan on doing at this time. And she says, "Well, I gave you notice." You know, anyway. But realistically,
Charles, I'm absolutely going to connect with you later on to get his information.
Yeah, well, or just go on municibid.com.
Yeah, right. Municibid. Yeah.
Municipid.com. There's all kinds of fire trucks on there for sale, from, you know, more or less smaller ones to, like, really, you know, most of them are engines for sale, aren't they? Not pump, not tankers.
Well, it depends, you know. And the thing is, the inventory changes daily. So, you know, and we don't really know what's coming up, you know, for auction. So, you know, there could be five fire trucks tomorrow listed, and you know, we'll know tomorrow.
Huh. Interesting. Have I missed anything about fire trucks? Is there something I should have been asking you?
No, I think we covered a lot of detail on it. Some people actually use them and convert them, again, depending on the type of truck, into mobile homes and RVs.
Well, right. Yeah, there's a huge market in that. The DIY market on converting ambulances into campers is awesome.
Yes.
Because they make very good campers. The reason is it's surprising. One of the many, many reasons, often they have a refrigerator already on board, but also their air conditioning units are usually very good on there. And that's a problem with people who are going to intend to live in it.
Yes, in fact, we did a whole big blog post on converting ambulances and RVs. So if you go to blog.municipid.com, you can search for just ambulance, and you'll find it. And yeah, it goes into a lot of detail on how to convert different types of ambulances and what to look for in different ambulances for what you're going to want in an RV or a mobile home.
The other thing about them is the power supplies in them are usually very, very good. You're usually set up to add a couple of solar panels and just go and be off grid with it. So
yeah, they can be very self-sufficient.
Yeah, and also some of them are all-wheel drive. Not all of them, but some of them are all-wheel drive, which make for one hell of it. You turn it into a sort of a Unimog, an overlander.
We sell those too.
Unimogs? Oh, that's right. I saw a Unimog on there.
Quite a bit, yeah.
What did the Unimog go for, if you remember?
Again, you know, it's all over the place depending on the condition and year and that sort of thing. But, you know, they can range from 10 grand up to 50 grand or more.
Oh, wow. That's a bargain, because most of the time you don't get into a Unimog for under $500,000.
Yeah, I mean, these are pretty worn out and used. So, yeah, but again, you know, it really does depend on condition. And the nice thing on Municipid is if you go and you do a search on Municipid, you can look at all the completed auctions. So you can do it. If you go into advanced
comparison,
put in a keyword and see exactly what things have sold for.
Uh-huh.
So it's all open and transparent.
So it's kind of like the comps on real estate.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
And if you're really doing it from, you know, a true comp, you need to really look at recent sales because, you know, there's all kinds of different market effects.
Yeah, like pandemics and tariffs and stuff. Eb, did you have any follow-up?
Nope, this has been great. Thank you.
You're welcome. Have a great day. Oh, I would say it opens a line, but we're pretty close to the top of the hour, and we already have Dean Weingarten in studio for the next hour. So how do people I was going to ask you, do you ever deal in any of the TSA stuff that gets confiscated at the airport screeners?
No, we only work with state and local governments, so we're not involved on the federal level.
Is that because of a decision you made that dealing with the federal government is more complicated, or is it just a matter of the relationships that you already have?
Well, they have their own system, GSA auctions.
Right.
Yeah. So it's they kind of have a solution already ready to go for that. So.
Well, that's government, a solution in search of a problem, isn't it?
Exactly.
So I said, in a less polite life, I used to say that government is a self-fornicating evidence, or edifice, I should say. But you're not still involved at the local level? You're not on the council any longer?
No, I just did one term.
Oh,
that's good. Yeah.
Did the experience of working in government scar you or teach you?
Oh no, I'm really grateful for that opportunity. I learned so much about so many different things. Just being involved in local government in a meaningful way. I was the vice president, and I was the director of finance committee, and I learned a lot. And and I've taken many lessons from that on. As I continue my career.
I'd be darned. So is Municibit it, or do you have other things that you want to do?
Well, we're revamping. We did a soft launch of our new company, surplus.com, this past year, but we're kind of revamping some things for a grand launch coming later this year.
Are you looking to develop branches in other states? Because I know a guy who's an entrepreneur who has a used building materials place here in Tucson that would love to look at another enterprise.
Yes, along the lines of surplus.com, that's something we would look at. With Municibit, it's all sort of what I'll call, I guess, self-contained.
Right.
Across the country.
If you don't mind, I will trade your information back and forth off the air. See if it's something maybe it's a lead for you and maybe it's a lead for him. All right. You, sir, are a blessing because you answer the question that's asked and you have a sense of humor about it. Greg Berry of Municipid.com, I appreciate your time.
Yeah, thank you so much. And again, happy Easter to you and your listeners.
And to you as well. All right. AM 1030, KVOI, Cortero, Tucson, The Voice. Stand by for America Armed and Free.